Okay, so I'll start, and you listen, and we'll go like that. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. That's the idea. Now we can clap. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. See, and that brings your more senses in. And if you have other instruments, you can also bring them in, and you can also jump up and down and dance if you want and get more, you know. Go like that. So then the next one is the famous Hare Krishna. It's called the Maha Mantra, the great mantra. And we'll use a little different tune here, same notes really, see. See if I can remember this one.
Can you tell us what this means?
Yeah, what this means is these are basically, you see, there's three words, Hare Krishna and Rama, and they're all names of God. Now they're all in the vocative case. which means in Sanskrit they have endings which indicate you're calling somebody, like O Krishna and so on. And the word Krishna means that person who is all attractive, the most attractive person. I don't consider this to be the names of a Hindu god. This is just God. I mean, generically speaking, that person who, if you had a universal beauty contest or strength contest or knowledge contest, would come out on top every time. That's the all attractive person.
God,
according to the Vedas, ultimately God is simultaneously impersonal and personal, both. Actually, it says that the people who are knowers of the absolute, ultimate, encounter that absolute is three different ways: as impersonal Brahman, and although it's a non-dual, as impersonal Brahman, as the super soul that the yogis discover, this kind of wise super knowledge in themselves, and then as the supreme personality of Godhead. So, but anyway, everybody chants these, whatever aspect they're interested in. Rama means one who feels and who gives the highest bliss. Again, a generic idea. And Hare is actually addressed to, if God is a person, see, some people worship a he god, some people worship a she god, and some people worship an it god. But because God is complete, God is he, she, and it. So Hare is to the feminine, the spiritual energy by which you're joined to God. That's what that one does. And so that's the meaning of this mantra.
Krishna.
Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Example of mantra meditation with music. I say you can do it with any instruments, except of course ones that allow you to chant like this. You have questions or anything I should like to?
I'd like to know what you do at your temple. And
what we do in our temple, sure. Well, we have this is an ashram, so ashram means really people who are engaged in some spiritual discipline. So we actually rise early in the morning, and we come together in a worship room, temple room, and we chant. We start at 4:30 in the morning. Actually, if you want any spiritual practice you want to do, and if you really want the right time to do it, is about the hour and a half before dawn. In India, this is called the Brahma Muhurta, and it's very, very peaceful. The late night guys have gone to bed, and the early risers haven't gotten up. And so it's very peaceful and very quiet. And so we get up to take advantage of that. So we chant together in a group. Actually, we do it standing up and dancing. We have little cymbals and drums and everything like that. And then we have time for this meditation on the beads. We have these beads, by the way, if you're interested. I got some sets of these. But another way to chant is there's 108 beads. This is a sacred number, is 108. And you kind of start, this keeps you in track of it, because we go around 16 times a day. I mean, there's a vow that we take. Eventually. And you chant like this: Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Nigiri, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Nigiri, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Nigiri, like that. Meditating. So this is individual chanting or meditating. But again, you notice how you got your tongue engaged, your ears engaged, your mind's engaged, actually even your sense of touch and everything like that. So it helps you concentrate. So we have time in the morning to do that. Then at 7 we have a little more chanting. Then we have a class, and there's another book called the Srimad Bhagavatam, one of the Vedic literature. We have a class in Vedic literature. We have lots of volumes. Each verse is there. It's a Sanskrit verse. We chant the verse in Sanskrit, and there's a translation, and then there's a commentary. We read the commentary and discuss it as a group. We have breakfast. All our food is vegetarian. And by the way, it's anybody drops in any time, feed you. Yeah, we have a Sunday feast, and you've been to one? Yeah, well, it's still going on. You can come back. Sure, the Sunday feast still goes on. The temple is open all day long, really. It's kind of semi-closed from about 1 to 4. But otherwise, and we have a 5 times a day. There's chanting, and there's prasadam, spiritual food for people to eat. And during the day, people do different things. Some people go to work. Some of us are full time. Come back in the evening, chant again. Have some study. People usually, because we get up early, we go to bed pretty early. Usually around 9, 9:30. As Benjamin Franklin said, early to bed, early to rise, right? We follow our illustrious Philadelphia predecessor.
Did I call you a night person? I went to an ashram once in upstate New York and I loved it, but
you couldn't.
I wasn't still up at 2 in the morning and everyone else had been asleep for hours.
I tell you, it takes a while to flip around, you know. I mean, before I was a devotee. Yeah. My wife and I, we used to eat our evening, our last meal around midnight or so. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, you know, go to bed at 2. My student, just so long as I didn't sign for any courses before noon, I was happy. Yeah, you have to become a day person, a morning person. But you see, if you get up at 3, it's dark out for a while.
I don't know, people have been trying to get into me my whole life that I will adjust. And, you know, I never thought I was charitable at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. I still don't think I got any work done until after 11, so. And I was up early.
Yeah.
But maybe I didn't bring right into
sometimes
it.
Sometimes come there, they just don't go to sleep.
Hey, we brought you some prasadam, some of our Sunday feast sample, the famous samosas.
I have a question not really related specifically to, well, it's related to meditation, but not specifically related to mantras or to your organization. I had an experience once, actually more than just twice, a friend who was his yoga teacher, but he's also had been into transcendental meditation. He does on a daily basis transcendental meditation. And a couple of times he demonstrated for me the process that he went through. And he did the kind of like levitating gum same thing. And I've only watched him do it twice, and on both occasions I really can't, I don't even know if I have the words to describe the feeling that I felt just as someone watching it. Like, almost like the feeling of being like in love where you just are like overwhelmed. And I don't know why. I was just watching it. It wasn't.
Really?
No, I wasn't. And I'm wondering whether you've heard of anything like that.
No. Well, you know, I don't know what they do with this bouncing thing. I mean, what's the levitation? They say. It is said, and I guess there's fairly reliable testimony under this, that at advanced stage of yoga practice, people develop what they call siddhis, which are yoga siddhis, which are what we would call maybe miraculous powers, but which according to yoga philosophy aren't miraculous in the sense that they don't really break the laws of nature, but rather they are just different laws. One of them is you can levitate, you become light. It's called lagima siddhi. You float or walk on water or things like that. And that's what is, but this bouncing doesn't really look like that. I don't know what it is. The other yoga siddhi is you become guru, you become heavy. You know, you can put your foot on the ground, nobody can lift it up because you're like, you're immobile. You know where you see that is people who are really good at certain kinds of martial arts like Tai Chi. They get that way that you can't move them, you know. They just sit there and you can't move them. Or they become so light you can't touch them, you know. They just, they're just not there wherever you go. And there are other yoga siddhis where you can like walk through walls, basically. You make yourself very tiny So that's what I know about. Now I've heard
but
about.
What's so fascinating about this? That
is it how you felt about it?
Observer.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
That
people can
reach a state within themselves.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
And this is the origin of yoga. Did you discuss that?
Of yoga? Well. Yeah, I mean, when it actually started, nobody really can trace out, you know. There, according to the Vedas, there were certain teachers who came and taught it, but that's supposed to be millions and millions, almost millions of years ago, and it kind of comes down, you know. Usually, according to the Vedas, any actually path of religion is taught by an avatar, someone who comes down from a spiritual platform and shows it. So it's not really kind of an invention. But I mean, yoga means just a discipline for linking oneself with transcendence.
And it's an Eastern.
Yeah, the word yoga comes from the Sanskrit, so it's situated in. But you find, like, just for example, this mantra yoga that we're talking about. So you find, like, for example, in the Christian tradition, certain people have discovered also what they would call repetitive prayer. Like the chanting of the Jesus prayer in the Orthodox Church as a way of concentrating the mind. So if people embark on a spiritual path and follow some of the same basic principles, they'll come to discover the same things or very similar things. So that technique is also there. I think they're universal laws. I think they're laws of spiritual life. It's too bad it's not a science, because it could be. I think it was regarded as a science at one time, but now there's people are a little distracted. But
I kind of think of.
So it was an Eastern philosophy. And probably developing way before Christianity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. 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 The dates go back before Christianity. Sure.
Do we have like an earliest date that they know?
No. The Vedas themselves give extraordinarily old dates, which go back before people thought there were human beings on the planets. I mean, basically, the Vedas give an alternative history of the universe, which is not accepted now. On the other hand, when scholars try to date these things, it's wild guesswork, at least when it comes to India, because there's just there's no history like we have in the West. You know how everybody in the West saves everything for history, and they put it in a presidential library, and they think everybody would be interested. In India, they try to create as little history as possible. It's just, until recently, it's been just the opposite. Why clutter things up with a lot of useless information? So what's so important about this world that I have to record everything that I do? So it makes it really that's what it says. According to the tradition, it says that writing is not a sign of advancement, but it's a sign of decline. That it used to be the Vedas were originally spoken, and people's memories were so good that they would simply hear and they would remember. And it's only when this latest age, Kali Yuga, began, that people's memories got so bad that they had to write things down. It's like a crutch.
Even the Western tradition, writing was considered like an act of evil.
Plato complained about it too, actually. Plato said that because people write things down, now they don't remember anymore. So actually, this is the idea. Like say there's some complicated mathematical thing, and one guy does it in his head and the other guy has a calculator. You think the guy with the calculator is more advanced, right?
What do you do when you wake up on a Sunday morning and you stand for yoga? If you respect life, then I guess you just don't pull out the camera.
If you wake up in the morning, there are ants all over your table. If you respect life, you say, just pull out the can of Raid and zap them, huh? That's right. If you respect life, the first thing you do is make sure.
Actually, it says in the Bhagavatam that animals are just like our children. So generally speaking, I send them out to play. Their ancestors send them out.
Yeah, if you come to our center, you know, you'll see people are like catching the bugs and, you know, taking them outside rather than just pumping them. Yeah, that's generally what we do.
So for newcomers, if I was interested in just kind of like learning more, and I'm free in the evenings, is there like a time or something that would be like a better time to come? Maybe like the Sunday feast.
Yeah.
Yeah, five in the evening. So.
Yeah. Good for you. Sunday at 5 o'clock, every Sunday at our center, we have a chanting, a little lecture, and a feast. Vegetarian feast.
And the ceremony at 5 and 7:30, so there's also an arty ceremony where the incense off covered and the tea lounge and water.
You know, we have a restaurant downtown. No. Yeah, Govinda's. It's at 1408 South Street, right in the corner, right now near Broad and South. And also, we have programs there. There's a program on Wednesday night. What time? 6? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It is. And they have some other days too, so you can go down there. Anyway, they have not only they have stuff like this Indian stuff, they also have vegetarian Philadelphia cheesesteaks. Just in case you like the local cuisine, they found a way to do it. They're really good.
Use weekly?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And a question. Do you consider Swami Prabhupada to be an incarnation of Krishna?
No.
The Lord Kathayana or the
name? No, he's not an incarnation of Krishna. He's a servant. He's a servant of Krishna. Human being who acts as Krishna's representative, yeah.
Who is this?
He's the founder of our organization,
yeah,
Americas. Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's God, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, in our tradition, one has a spiritual master who acts towards the disciple as God's representative, as a teacher. And so because he's God representative, he's honored like that, but not to be confused with God. It's different. You know, just like, for example, if an ambassador visits a country, he's received, because he represents the president or somebody, you know, is received as a representative. And it's given certain kind of treatment, but it doesn't mean it's the same as the head of state, or something like that. Do a certain amount of formal courtesy or something.
When you see these things that say Kali Yoga at the University of Pennsylvania, there's a place.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are other yogi churches. I know people in other yogi churches that go to yoga. What are the differences and similarities between?
Well, when I was talking about yoga earlier, there's a kind of traditional classic yoga, which is really a very severe, very serious anyway, spiritual discipline. But it has many good side effects for your health, physical health, and also for your mental health. And so there are many spin-offs which concentrate on those things, and don't really follow them all the way out as a spiritual discipline. I mean, some people may become interested and go further, but see, like the early stages of yoga, this Ashtanga yoga, it really does. It makes you. It's a very good system of exercise and stretching your muscles and getting your lymph flowing and all those kinds of things. And people who practice that yoga, they don't get heart disease, they don't build up cholesterol and all those kind of things like that. And so people just do that sometimes as an end in itself. And that's okay. I mean, that's, you know, why not? So it's probably a lot better for you than so many other things that people do for their health.
It's like seeing
It's
like transcendental meditation with exercise.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You know, but I think if you can kind of quiet your body, it sort of quiets the rest of you.
It sure does. No, it definitely. You quiet your body, then you help you quiet your mind. And if you can actually become peaceful in your mind, you know, that's really great. Because how many people are...
I go to Joel's center, and I haven't been going regularly, and I haven't been, I guess, in a week, and I know I'm all kind of like that, and I know reacting and bouncing, and I know that after I go once, I'm, you know, for a few days, kind of like, whoa, you know, I'm a little bit more mellow, a little bit
sure, amazing. Right.
You know, like somebody's doing something that opens them up to something more of a good goodness, then they're just more attuned to something that's transcendent, you know, so... It may not be what they're originally going for, but you know, it changes the consciousness.
See, like this basic thing in the Vedic philosophy. They say that material nature has three modes. They're called gunas, three ways of acting. Like we see that things are being created around us, things last for a while, and things are being destroyed. Right? And then the byproducts of destruction are put together, and then again there's creation. So there's a cycle, creation, maintenance, destruction, creation, maintenance, destruction. So when material things are being created, material nature is said to be in Rajaguna, you could say the mode of passion. When things are being maintained, it's called Sattvaguna, the mode of goodness or purity. And when things are being destroyed, it's called Tamaguna, the mode of darkness or the mode of ignorance. But according to the Vedas, also these modes affect us psychologically. And the modes are, the word guna means a strand. So you can imagine a rope of woven of three strands. So these three modes are kind of woven together. But they're psychological. Like for example, the mode of passion. When we are in the mode of passion, we are full of hankerings and desires and longings. We're really active. We want this, we want that. When we get what we want, we still want and we have to get more. And we can't stop and we're kind of driven people. This is the mode of passion. Really, our whole civilization is prominently in the mode of passion. Our standard of advancement is the standard of the mode of passion. And the Bhagavad Gita says that the result of the mode of passion is ultimately misery. Because your desires go on increasing, and actually you're never satisfied. When you get what you're after, it's not what you wanted, and you always want more. So this, but this is the mode of passion. Just ceaseless activity, driven to go on, you know, free trade, Manhattan, you know, all this stuff. The mode of ignorance, when things are being destroyed psychologically, it means one becomes discouraged or lazy, unmotivated, depressed, insane, intoxicated. That's the mode of ignorance. The mode of goodness is the one that's purer than the others, and a person situated in the mode of goodness, the consciousness is serene, peaceful, very alert and interested in everything, in a position to learn and to see, but detached, able to accept what comes of its own, able to give up things that they lose without being, this is the mode of goodness. So what any kind of discipline like yoga does, if you do it right, it'll tend to reduce the mode of passion and ignorance. And when one is situated in the mode of goodness, actually you're just naturally kind of happy. You're just content. You're just a cheerful, happy, content person, kind of interested in, you're interested in everything that goes on, but at the same time you're not driven. But see, in the mode of passion, people have this narrow, intensely focused consciousness on the object of desire, and we see everything in the mode of passion in kind of a distorted way, because we're looking through the lens of what we want, and we just evaluate everything as in our terms of, will it help me get what I want, or it will not help me get what I want, and we don't see the world as it is. And of course, in the mode of ignorance, you're like Mr. Jones in the Bob Dylan song, you know, something's happening but you don't know what it is, you're just a state of oblivion or whatsoever. So these are the three modes of nature. There's a very, in the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there's a really acute psychological analysis. And some people are like sort of constitutionally situated in one mode or another, but the idea about spiritual discipline is that it should eventually, as Sadamani was saying, you when you experience that kind of happiness and calmness and peace and equilibrium of mind, that means that the mode of goodness is there, and the mode of passion. So Donald Trump will never get there. Mode of goodness, you'll not see any mode of goodness on Fox TV. Yeah.
What's an example of food in the mode of passion?
Hot and salty things.
Over spicy, yeah.
Dry.
Even in the mode of passion.
Hmm? And actually,
I don't know, some kind of, you know, maybe hot sauce with chips or something.
Yeah.
Like,
and then,
yeah, look at most fast food.
It's
over salted. It's really in the mode of passion.
But it all tastes like crap.
Yeah, of course. It all. Food in the mode of passion tastes like crap. And food in the mode of ignorance is anything that's rotten, decayed, you know. Pickled pig's feet. Anything that's over a few days old is in the mode of ignorance.
Anything frozen?
That means frozen, yeah. But it affects you psychologically. As it is said, it was actually originally said by a German philosopher, man ist, was er ist, you are what you eat. Later said by George Harrison, but actually it was Feuerbach who said it. And then who picked up on it was George Bernard Shaw and then George Harrison. that's the. In German it sounds better, man ist, was er ist. You are what you eat. Yeah, and you know, that's another thing. If you just take to a vegetarian diet immediately, you know, things get better. No, and it's better for your health too, automatically. It's also good for your spiritual life too. And the mode of goodness is, in the mode of goodness, see, that's the position from which you can actually advance further into what's called transcendental to the modes altogether, the spiritual position. which is described sometimes as purified goodness, like that.
Where do you draw the vegetarian line? Like things with eyes or things with faces?
Huh?
Where do you draw, like, I know that's French.
Oh, there's different kinds of vegetarians, aren't there? Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 Well, our particular thing is we don't eat meat or fish or eggs.
Dairy?
Yeah, we eat dairy. Although you may not want to because of the way the cows are treated, but ultimately, and. You remember that Krishna was originally a cowherd.
He was what?
He was a cowherd.
I have to explain to you about the sacred cows of India, huh? What that means. Doesn't mean they're God, by the way. Yeah, sure. Allen Ginsberg used to go around the harmonium, he'd chant Hare Krishna, and he'd chant Gatte Gatte Parigatte Paribuddhi Swaha, the Buddhist.
One thing is, like, so far out, we were just in India and having, like, milk from cows protected from the time they were born, and they were allowed to just, you know, they're never killed even when they're older, so the milk that you get right from them is completely different.
Even if you go, like, to a scene, you get organic milk, it just doesn't taste the same as coming from the house, and, you know, in a loving way, and it's really nice. That was one of the nice things there. My impression was from the Prabhupada, obviously, from those books, and I was getting back to God, Yeah, let me know if you can do up. Why would you call this Sunta to your mother but not a Sunta to kill a cow, and the cow would be burned if you know that?
That's right.
As long as the cow is sort of a surrogate mother, because...
The cow is sacred because she's your mother.
Right.
And your mother is sacred. Did you know that, too? Nope, nobody knows that anymore, either. Anyway, that's...
I know it, but I forget a lot.
Yeah, right. Got to remind her, too, every so often. The cow, you should imagine, you have to imagine an agrarian society. These are your main domestic animals that really increase your productivity. A cow and a bull. Cow giving milk, because you need some animal protein, and is where it comes from the milk of the cow. The cow gives milk. And bull plows your fields for you. And so, because the cow gives you milk, she's your mother. And here's the bull, plows your field, therefore earns your wealth, is your father and supports you. So here are your domestic animals. And it's said that the cow is a natural symbol of the earth and the bull is a natural symbol of religious principles. So imagine, like, so this is where your wealth comes from. These are the kind of material nature, the non-human part of nature that you're dealing with, that you're deriving your wealth from. So instead of something you just exploit and use, instead you say, no, these are like my father and mother, I have to take care of them. It puts you in the right relationship with the non-human part of the world and with the environment. It's really actually so wonderful, the effect it has of kind of mitigating, you know, the sort of exploitive and greedy mentality that can develop by simply understanding that I have to respect and honor, because the cow and the bull have given me so much, now I have obligations toward them, and I have to treat them this so.
Once you get out of the country too, and you see like houses, there's not like much difference between like cows like inside, and you know, the cows have got, they got like, they make them bowls so that it's up closer, you know, put the food, you know, and so it really is, it's like your pets, you know.
Well, let me tell you something. Cows are extremely clean. They're considered to be very clean animal, and everything that comes from them is clean. So that cow dung is not like the waste of any other animal, because it's actually antiseptic. Now, because of modern feedlots, it's not that way anymore. But I met some old farmers in Maine. Who told me that, you know, they always, whenever they got a cut, they'd put cow dung on it, and it would not get infected. But what they do in India, the cow dung is like enormously useful. They do two things. One, like the traditional houses in Bengal, for example, there are these very thick-walled houses that are made of mud. You make mud and you just dry it and they become very, very thick, and they last for years and years and years if they stay dry and rats don't tunnel into them. But then they make a plaster, the inside where we'd have like some kind of plaster, you know, they take cow dung, mix it with water and smear it on, and it makes a smooth surface and it becomes hard. No flies on it, and those houses are enormously cool. And so they live like that with cow dung, and it's considered clean. It is clean. Nobody gets sick from the cows, from the cow dung. And the other thing is, of course, is you can burn it. People just collect it and make these little patties. You know, if you go to India, you see these round things on the walls. They stuck on there as they dry, and then they put them in the fire. You have handprints on them. And they burn it, you know, they in the cooking fires, it's all this methane comes out. So it's extremely useful. And then also use it to fertilize the field, of course. You just compost it for a while and put it on there. That's a great system, you know, but of course it's agrarian. I mean, it's labor intensive, no machines. You have to really be a different way of life. It's probably better for you. I know it's better for you.
Do you see a difference now with increasing westernization in India?
Oh yeah, sure. Of course, it's going fast. Oh yeah, you know, everybody has tractors and all those kind of things.
And then also there's influence because it's high in butter fat. They always kind of push water buffalo, which the milk's not as good for you, but it has a higher butter content. So we're trying to
Yeah, anyway, you're saying, I mean, India, just since I've been going to India, it's changed so much, you know. Now everybody has the internet and satellite TV and all that other kind of stuff. And you have to go pretty far out in the hinterlands, you know, to get away from that stuff now. It's gone everywhere. And it's all part of the modern world.
Plus, we import a lot of vegan food here. So, it's probably, you know, like, not as, you know, you're out there in the rural, but you kind of don't trust the vegetables and stuff.
Yeah, most of the world's computer reprocessing is done there.
Yeah, I know. Uh-huh. I'm Bhopal, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, what it was, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. That was pretty.
It was partially because the procedure of the law, some of the data, it was like it shouldn't have been allowed to be able to done, but
mm-hmm. Well, one nice thing about mantra meditation is that it can be done any place, any time, you know. Even if you're not able to do all the other things, or you know, like if you just
chant for a while, and immediately that's kind of an issue of consciousness. I mean, you can combine it with other types of yoga. It's very, very simple, doesn't require.
Yeah, you don't need a special room, you don't need a mat, you don't need special clothes. And even if everybody's around you, you know, you can just chant it in your head. You know, you don't have to use your voice, although that's nice, but I put a pair of earplugs on and sit in the train or the subway, you know. Everybody else sitting there talking to themselves anyway on a cell phone, it doesn't make any difference now. It used to be you think you're weird. You see everybody having discourse with the empty air all the time.
Huh?
Yeah, you thought they were weird, right?
Especially in New York City, you walk down the street, everybody's walking down the street talking away because
they've got the most hidden ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things have changed.
You've got to wonder why it is that people don't like to spend time just with themselves. Yeah. Why it has to be filled.
Yeah, in fact.
Enjoying the mood of, what was it, passion?
Yeah, and they find themselves very bad company, actually. They want to get away. That's tough.